Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. This episode is rated a 5. In 2015, 22-year-old Heather Maples packed up her bags and moved across the country from Texas to Tennessee for new opportunities and a fresh start. But only a week after she learned she was accepted into college at Middle Tennessee State University, she was found brutally murdered in her off-campus apartment. Although several persons of interest immediately surfaced, police were ultimately led to her killer through one key clue, a clear-as-day, bloody fingerprint left at the scene. This episode is titled A Pristine Print. So without further ado, let's get started. Nicole Maples was born on August 23, 1992, in Ocala, Florida. Her mom remembers this day particularly well, not just because it was the day of birth for her oldest child, but also because it was right smack in the middle of a record storm, Hurricane Andrew. "So she was known as my hurricane baby," said her mother, Jennifer Hunter, on an episode of Oxygen's Final Moments. Sometime after Heather was born, Heather's family moved to Mesquite, Texas, a suburb near Dallas. There, Heather attended junior high and high school, and in 2004, when she was in the 7th grade, her mom gave birth to another child, Heather's little brother, Ryan. Jennifer said Heather was ecstatic to be a big sister, and from the moment he was born, she doted on him constantly. At a young age, however, Ryan was diagnosed with a development disorder, which made Heather even more attentive to her younger brother. Jennifer said, quote, "All of Heather's high school years were spent with Ryan, helping Ryan learn how to talk, learn how to walk. She just immersed herself with helping to raise and take care of Ryan," end quote. But when she wasn't helping with Ryan, she was living a typical teenage life, talking about boys and future plans with her best friend, Jenna Holt Gomez. Jenna said she and Heather first met in elementary school in Dallas and were inseparable from there on out. She said, quote, "I was actually a really shy, quiet, introverted girl. I was afraid to speak to people. Heather just completely brought me out of my shell," end quote. Jenna described Heather as outgoing and friendly and kind. Jenna said, quote, "She knew what words to say to make you feel better. Literally 5 minutes of talking with Heather and you would forget that you're even sad about anything. And Heather was really good at helping people," end quote. And that's exactly what Heather decided to do when she began looking into college. Jennifer, Heather's mom, explained, quote, "Heather wanted to go to college. She was interested in pursuing a career. She had decided that she was going to be a counselor. She had always been that friend. She was that listening ear because she was such a compassionate person," end quote. When Heather was 22 years old, living in Texas, one of her high school friends, a guy named Chaz, called her up and suggested she join him in Tennessee. Specifically, he was in Murfreesboro, a quaint little college town that's home to Middle Tennessee State University. And the thought of this truly excited Heather. Her best friend, Jenna, said, quote, "She loved the idea of moving to Tennessee. She just wanted to start over and do something different," end quote. So, in January of 2015, Heather decided to take the plunge and head to Tennessee. Jenna said, quote, "I remember she packed up her entire car and I was so depressed that she was leaving, but I understood, and I admired her courage," end quote. Heather arrived in Murfreesboro that winter and moved in with Chaz at first so she could take some time to settle in and get acquainted with a new town. Together, the two lived in the Cove Apartments, but what started off as a platonic friendship with Chaz soon turned into a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship. And everything seemed to be going well for them as Heather was acclimating to the fresh start. Not long after moving in with Chaz, Heather met and quickly became friends with a young woman who worked at the apartment's leasing office, Kelsey Price. On an episode of Final Moments, Kelsey described herself as Heather's closest friend in Tennessee. She said, quote, "My first impression of Heather was, wow. I mean, I was in awe. She just gave off this vibe, this light about her, and I said to myself, this girl is going to be my best friend," end quote. And they soon became just that, especially when Kelsey helped Heather land a job working right beside her in the leasing office at the apartments where they both lived. As the months passed, so did Heather's relationship with Chaz. By April of 2015, their relationship had completely crumbled and the two broke up. While Chaz moved out of the apartment, Heather decided to stay so she could continue living and working in the same place. By early August, just a few months later, Heather had settled into her new city well and was thoroughly enjoying the next chapter of her life in Tennessee. She had several friends she hung out with regularly, including Kelsey, and she had a good, steady job at her apartment complex. But perhaps the most exciting part of Heather's life during this time was when she applied for admission to MTSU and was accepted. Her mom, Jennifer, recalled how thrilled Heather was to tell her the news. Jennifer said, quote, "She was on the phone with me, and all she kept saying was, 'Oh my gosh, Mom, oh my gosh.' I was like, 'What?' And she said, 'I was accepted to college. I'm going to college.' And I was like, 'You're doing what?' She was so excited, and I was so happy for her because that was something that she did on her own. It was her proud moment," end quote. Sadly, however, Heather would never get the chance to fulfill her dream of college. About a week after she received her acceptance letter from MTSU, on August 7th, 2015, Heather was scheduled to work a shift with Kelsey in the leasing office. That morning, however, Heather never showed. Kelsey explained, quote, "She had a tendency to, you know, sleep in, and so there were a lot of mornings where I would have to call her. About 9:15, I'm like, 'Okay, Heather's not here.' So I call a couple of times, I don't get any answer," end quote. But Kelsey recalled that Heather had always told her, you know, if she didn't answer the phone, to just go to her apartment and, you know, like wake her up and get her. So Kelsey did just that. She walked to Heather's apartment, and when she noticed the door was unlocked, she went inside. When she did, however, she was traumatized by what she discovered. Kelsey said, quote, "So when I open the door, I see her mattress and I see her laying there and I'm calling out to her. I'm like, 'Heather, Heather?' I walk over to her and I notice that she has a top on, but nothing else. And I'm like, 'Gosh, she really got on one last night.' So I look at her foot. I tap it. I'm like, 'Heather?' And when I tap it, I realize it's dead cold. I slowly start to back out of the apartment. I was like, just breathing and thinking like, 'What the hell is going on?' I called 911 and they say, 'What's your emergency?' And I say, 'I think there's been a homicide here,'" end quote. After this, authorities quickly responded to the scene and determined that Heather was deceased, and it appeared that she had, in fact, been murdered. Detective Larry Maples with the Murfreesboro Police Department was the first investigator to arrive. Upon immediate observation, he noted that there was clear evidence of sexual assault, and they were able to collect a DNA sample from semen that was present. Detective Sergeant Tommy Massey was the second investigator to arrive, who confirmed Maple's observation. Massey added, quote, "Her hair was fairly blood-soaked. We were able to note that there was some cast-off blood on the wall behind the mattress. Obviously, she had been struck on the bed, and then whatever object was used to strike her had delivered blood to the wall," end quote. The thing is, though, the scene was incredibly gruesome and graphic. In an interview with Oxygen's Final Moments, Detective Maples described one detail in particular that I do want to share with you, because it indicated just how horrifying the scene was. He said, quote, "The most gut-wrenching part was seeing Heather's hand still grasping the sheet, where you could tell, as she died, that she died a pretty horrific death," end quote. Now, obviously, investigators set out to gather as much information and evidence as possible, as quickly as possible. As they were processing the scene for evidence, they found Heather's cell phone. It was lying on a nightstand right next to her bed. But it was password protected, so they'd have to wait a while before they could gain access and sort through her most recent communication. However, investigators did find one piece of evidence that quickly became their smoking gun. They noticed a bloody fingerprint at the top of Heather's bed to the right of her body. Detective Massey described the print as pristine because it was a clear, solid print. Massey said, quote, "You could not have taken ink and rolled that fingerprint and had a better print," end quote. And considering the position that Heather was found in, led detectives to believe with 100% certainty that the print had to belong to her killer. Now they just needed to find a match to both the print and the semen they had collected at the scene. Upon looking closer at the crime scene, investigators noticed that all the windows in her apartment were closed and locked, so the only way inside was through Heather's front door. They noted that there was no forced entry and that the murder didn't appear to be a random act. This meant that Heather likely knew her killer. While detectives set out to identify potential suspects, Kelsey asked them if she could be the one to deliver the news to Heather's mom, Jennifer. Kelsey recalled, quote, "I wanted it to be from somebody who loved Heather and cared about her. So I called and I just said, 'Jennifer, are you sitting down?'" End quote. In an interview on Final Moments, Jennifer said, quote, "I remember her just telling me that Heather's gone. And I was like, 'Where is Heather?' Because I knew Heather was supposed to be at work. And then she said, 'Heather is dead.' I just remember screaming, 'No, somebody's killed my daughter.' But it wasn't real. It didn't seem real." End quote. Naturally, the first person investigators spoke to was Kelsey, not only because she was the one who found Heather, but also because she was Heather's closest friend in Murfreesboro, and she could give them the most information about Heather's latest movements and activities, you know, where she'd been and who she'd been in contact with recently. Kelsey first informed them about Heather's relationship with her ex-boyfriend, Chaz, and she described it as tumultuous at best. Kelsey said there were allegations of Chaz being abusive toward Heather and that he had anger issues. Kelsey also told investigators something that tossed up a huge red flag. Apparently, Heather's and Chaz's relationship had been so rocky that Heather had even taken out a restraining order against him. So, investigators needed to have a conversation with him. But before they could reach out to Chaz, another person interrupted the investigation, as in he literally showed up to Heather's apartment right smack in the middle of an active crime scene. Detective Maples explained this further. He said, quote, "A young man came just about bursting through the crime scene. His name was Michael, and he was very determined to get inside that tape, get inside that scene," end quote. At first, investigators were incredibly concerned. They considered the distinct possibility that this guy might just be the suspect coming back to the scene and inserting himself into the investigation, which, as campus cronies, we know that to be kind of a common thing among perpetrators. I mean, it's not unheard of for them to revisit a crime scene and insert themselves into the investigation to see what they can find out and, you know, like determine if they are on police's radar, or even to just be sick and, you know, see their work, see what they've done. Anyway, Detective Maples said, quote, "The interesting part was that he had Heather's keys. No one forced themselves into her apartment and she's dead. So certainly that's somebody we want to have a conversation with," end quote. So this Michael guy agreed to go to the police station for a formal interview, and they quickly discovered that he seemed genuinely upset that Heather was dead. He was open and honest and forthcoming, and he appeared to truly want to help. He explained to investigators that he was simply a good friend of Heather's, that the two of them had never had any type of physical contact beyond like a hug. And he said he believes that he may have been one of the last people to see Heather. I mean, he did have the keys to her apartment after all. So during the interview with Michael, police learned that he and Heather had went out to dinner the night before at Old Chicago, a national pizza chain restaurant. Afterward, Michael said he went home, but that Heather stayed out and went to some local bars with some different friends. However, later that night, Heather reached back out to Michael, this time for help. Michael said, quote, "She called me at 11:40. She tells me that I need to come to the bar. She really needs me right now. There's people hitting on her and she's really upset. I was like, okay, I'll be up there, end quote. Apparently, Heather had told Michael that she was being harassed, or more like bothered and annoyed, by a guy named Artavio. Michael explained that Artavio had been following her around at the bar. He had been handsy or a little pushy and aggressive toward her. Once Michael arrived, they hung out at the bar for a little while, but eventually Heather told him that she was ready to leave because she was hungry and wanted to grab something to eat. So Michael drove Heather to a bar and grill called Handlebars, where Heather ordered some food. After that, Michael said he drove her back to her apartment and dropped her off. He said he watched her walk up the stairs toward her apartment, which was around 2:30 in the morning at that point. Here's the thing, though. Remember, he had her keys. So Michael told investigators Heather's door must have been unlocked. When police pressed Michael about why he had her keys in the first place, though, he gave them a perfectly logical explanation. He informed them that she didn't have a purse or pockets to carry the keys, so she asked Michael to hang on to them for her. Then, when he dropped her off at home, he just simply forgot to give them back. Now, while detectives seemed to believe Michael's story, they did collect his fingerprints and a DNA swab for good measure, which Michael voluntarily submitted to. The next step for investigators was to figure out what happened to Heather between 2:30 a.m. and a few hours later when Kelsey discovered her in her apartment. So they turned to surveillance footage from the bars and establishments in hopes of tracking her movements. Detective Maples said, quote, "We had ideas of where she was, but again, knowing where she was and knowing what she's doing while she's there are very different things," end quote. They discovered that everything Michael had told them matched up. According to the reporting of Mary Reeves for the Murfreesboro Daily News Journal, when Heather first went out that night, she visited a place called Gentleman Jim's at around 10 p.m. This is the place where Michael met up with Heather at about 11:40 p.m. This is also the bar where that guy, Artavio, was supposedly hitting on her and following her around. From there, surveillance footage confirmed that Michael and Heather went to Handlebars to grab some food at the timestamps Michael had given to them. So, detectives believed that once Michael dropped Heather off at her apartment at about 2:30 a.m. on August 7th, that she never left again, which meant they needed to figure out who Heather was communicating with that night and who might have visited her after she returned home. While they waited for access to her cell phone records, they turned to the medical examiner's report for additional clues. Officially, Heather's death was ruled a homicide as the result of strangulation and blunt force trauma to the head. A rape kit additionally confirmed that she was sexually assaulted, but it also provided a DNA sample, which was quickly turned over to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab. And upon comparing Michael's fingerprints and DNA to the samples collected at the scene, investigators were officially able to cross him off the list of suspects because his DNA was not a match. Now, investigators needed to circle back around to Chaz, Heather's ex-boyfriend. Apparently, Chaz had moved not just out of the apartment he shared with Heather, but he had also moved out of town completely. The interesting thing was, though, that they learned he had actually been back in town the night of her murder. So they paid old Chaz a visit. When detectives interviewed him, he too was forthcoming. He acknowledged that their relationship had been rocky, but he firmly denied having anything to do with her murder. Plus, he said he had an alibi. He was out that night in a completely different place with completely different people, which police were able to verify. And the time frame just didn't fit with the murder anyway. Still, Chaz agreed to provide a DNA sample, which was not a match either. After this, detectives went back to Kelsey, hoping she could provide some more answers. Kelsey said, quote, "They wanted to get as much information about her and her life as they could. They wanted to know about sex lives, I mean everything," end quote. Kelsey informed them that after she broke up with Chaz, Heather became much more social and started making a lot more friends. Kelsey said, quote, "She immediately was so happy, so free. She could really spread her wings and fly at this point. She was just very charismatic. I think everybody was crushing on Heather. I mean, literally, she was like a boy magnet. She had men around her all the time, you know, staring and wanting," end quote. So Kelsey provided detectives with names of everyone she could think of that Heather had talked to or met in the past few months. She also mentioned a Snapchat that Heather had sent her from the night before. It was a picture of Heather and Artavio together at Gentleman Jim's, which was the last piece of communication Kelsey ever received from Heather. And, to detective's surprise, Kelsey informed them that she knew Heather's passcode to her phone, which meant they had immediate access to the contents of her phone and no longer had to wait on the cell phone records to gain access. A huge break in the case for them. Or so they thought. Detective Maples said, quote, "When we went through Heather's phone, we were able to start piecing together a timeline of her last few minutes," end quote. They discovered that around the same time Michael dropped Heather off at her apartment, she had sent a text to Artavio asking him to come over to her place. That was just a few hours before she was found murdered. So, needless to say, they went straight to Artavio. Here's the thing, though. When they interviewed him, they quickly realized that he was completely unaware that Heather had died. So they used it to their advantage to see if it changed his answers to their questions. Artavio told investigators that even though Heather texted him to come over, he never went. He said he had already fallen asleep when she sent the text and that he didn't even see the text until way later the next morning when he woke up. He also voluntarily provided a DNA sample, which, again, was not a match. So investigators circled back to the list of names that Kelsey had given them. And one name in particular kept coming up with all accounts from that night, a guy named Brandon Bowling. Kelsey said, quote, "I told them about Brandon. She just met him and his roommate one night not too long before that. She introduced me to them, and that was the only time I had ever met them, and I never thought about it again, really," end quote. As police looked into Brandon Bowling, they realized that he often hung out in the same bars that Heather did. But that night specifically, the night of August 6th and into the next morning of August 7th, they couldn't place him at the same bars at the same time as Heather, so they couldn't prove that he was with her or even near Heather that night. Detectives explained on the episode of Final Moments that they worked on Heather's case for 7 straight days with very little breaks or sleep. But finally, all that hard work paid off. About a week after Heather's murder, they got a hit on the bloody fingerprint collected at the scene. And lo and behold, the print belonged to Brandon Bowling. According to investigators, his fingerprints had been submitted to the APHIS system by a company he was seeking employment with, which is how they got the hit. Obviously, after this, Bowling became their number one suspect, and they needed to find out more information about him ASAP. They learned that he was a 22-year-old senior at MTSU, as well as a delivery driver for the restaurant chain Jimmy John's. So they paid him a visit at work. More specifically, they found him in the parking lot of Jimmy John's and asked him to go to the station for an interview. During the interview, Bowling admitted that he knew Heather and that he had been to her apartment before. He said he hooked up with her the second time they met, but never since. He also said that the last time he was at Heather's place was back in July, about a month before. But detectives knew he was lying because how did his bloody fingerprint get there if he hadn't been there in weeks? They said it was so fresh that the fingerprint was still wet when they arrived on the scene. Detective Maples said, quote, "Once we confronted him with physical evidence, you could see his demeanor change. His shoulders drop, head drops. It seemed like he was starting to gather or collect the fact that, you know, he's had, that we know it, we've got it," end quote. While investigators felt like he was on the verge of a full-blown confession to the murder, he never cracked. He maintained his innocence and even reluctantly agreed to provide a DNA sample. At this point, though, the DNA match confirmation was just a matter of time, because just based on the fingerprint match alone, they had enough to arrest him on the spot. So on August 15th, 2015, 8 days after Heather was so brutally and tragically murdered, Brandon Bowling was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Heather's mom, Jennifer, described how she felt when they called to give her the news of the arrest. Jennifer said, quote, "Detective Massey called me to let me know that he had caught someone, and it was a sigh of relief. But again, we had no idea who he was or why did he do it. I mean, that's the one question that I still have, is why? I still don't know," end quote. Immediately after his arrest, police subpoenaed his phone record so they could start building a case against him. And as soon as they gained access to his cell phone, they discovered chilling details of the rape and murder. It was all right there in a video on his phone. Assistant District Attorney J. Paul Newman described what they found. Embrace yourselves, because without being too graphic, it is quite disturbing. Newman said, quote, "The video from the cell phone of Brandon Richmond Bowling was one of the most shocking videos I have ever seen in my career. You could see the room of Heather Nicole Maples. You could see the bed. You could see Heather Nicole Maples being raped, and you know that at this time, she was alive. It was obvious she had been beaten and she was suffering. The thing that struck me the most was that I was watching the final moments of the life of Heather Nicole Maples." End quote. Mary Reeves, for the Daily News Journal, reported that most of the evidence against Bowling was presented at his bond hearing, which is when he was officially indicted by a grand jury for first-degree murder. It was in late August of 2015. At the hearing, it was revealed that the photos of the crime scene were too graphic to show the court, so only the judge was allowed to see them. But investigators explained to the judge how Heather was found lying face down, partially clothed, on a mattress on the floor of her apartment. She also had two lacerations on her head, and there were signs of strangulation. Additionally, massive hemorrhaging was found in her eyes, mouth, and throat areas, and one of her fingernails had been torn off. During the hearing, Agent David Hoover with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation testified that he was able to determine that the print found in a blood-stained sheet was that of Bowling's right thumb. And after all evidence was presented, ADA Newman requested that Bowling's bond be set at $1 million, as opposed to the $50,000 proposed by Bowling's defense attorney. Newman said, quote, "I think his fingerprint in the blood is devastating evidence. I think the likelihood of conviction is great," end quote. In response, Judge Ben Hall McFarland agreed with the prosecution and set his bond at $1 million. The judge said, quote, "Looking at the likelihood of conviction and protection of the community, I debated setting a bond at all," end quote. Ultimately, Bolin was indicted by a grand jury, and he was charged with 6 counts of rape, 2 counts each of sexual battery, aggravated rape, and first-degree murder. And because his bond was set so high, he was never able to come up with the money. So he remained incarcerated at the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center throughout his legal proceedings. Eventually, in February of 2018, Bowling signed a plea deal where he pleaded guilty to rape and murder. At his plea hearing, once again, the details of the scene were so graphic that only the judge was allowed to see photographic evidence. The public and the rest of the courtroom, including the media, were not allowed to view it. During the hearing, Detective Massey offered most of the testimony about what happened to Heather. It was during the plea hearing that we learned that not only was Bowling's DNA the only match they found, but his DNA hit all 16 of 16 total DNA samples taken from Heather's body. So essentially, they could determine that it was his DNA with 100% certainty. The only thing the prosecution couldn't prove was that Heather and Bowling were ever in the same place at the same time on the night or early morning of her murder. You see, Bowling was also out at bars that night. He first went to a place called Whiskey Dick's, and then on to Gentleman Jim's and even Handlebars. But surveillance footage never placed them at those establishments at the same time. And as far as communication went, there was none between Heather and Bowling that night, like at all. Investigators actually couldn't find one single traceable interaction between the two of them for about 3 whole weeks. So even though they weren't sure why Bowling went over to Heather's that night, or what time he went over there exactly, or even his motive for the crime, they did know without a doubt that it happened and that he was the one who did it. Ultimately, at the plea hearing, Judge David Bragg sentenced 25-year-old Bowling to 40 years in prison for second-degree murder and 15 years for aggravated rape, with the sentences to run concurrently. At the conclusion of the plea and sentencing hearing, Jennifer Hunter found Bowling's mother, Patricia Ann Bowling, in the hallway, and the two embraced in a long, emotional hug. Jennifer said, quote, "I wanted to be sure that she and I connected because they are victims too. They didn't plan this. They had hopes for their child just like we had hopes for ours. I've prayed for them ever since this happened," end quote. Jennifer also expressed how much their family misses Heather every single day. She said, quote, "She was a daughter. She was a big sister. Our life took a turn. Our lives since she's been gone have been awful. We miss her terribly. She was our everything. She had so many friends. She had such a beautiful life ahead of her. But I know where she is. She is in heaven. She is looking down on us, smiling. She's at peace. She's not hurting anymore. Like I said, she is our first thought in the morning and our last thought at night. There's not a day that goes by that Heather's name is not mentioned in our home. And that's how it will be forever." End quote. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of Chronicle 76. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I always post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. And y'all, just an announcement to remind you that I'm going back to a 2-week schedule. So now my episodes will come out every other Monday instead of every Monday. I tried the weekly thing. I really did. And with my full-time job and my life, I just could not make it work. So I apologize for that. I tried, but it just wasn't conducive to my schedule. However, if you can't get enough of Campus Crime Chronicles, I do still have my Patreon. So I really would love for you guys to check that out. You can listen to all of my episodes ad-free. Plus, you'll get at least one bonus chronicle each month, sometimes even more if I can swing it. You'll also get a personalized note from me, Dr. T, which includes a Campus Crime Chronicles sticker as well. Essentially, my Patreon is a space for all things campus crime related, so I would love for you guys to check it out. There's a direct link on my social media, on both Facebook and Instagram. Okay, y'all, well, that is all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.